بيتك وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فقدت حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق امنيتك
رصد السيارة وهويتك وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فكرت حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق أمنيتك
انسرقنا من أرضنا بلدنا انغلبنا عحالنا انقلبنا اقنعونا وتدربنا نحمي إسرائيل من حالنا صرنا ممسوكين عساكر وين مكان بس اللي كل هاد لمين وين 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 الملايين وين الملايين اللي بدنا تحرر فلسطين.
Welcome back. This is Background Briefing. I'm Tom Lutz, editor of the Los Angeles Review of Books, sitting in for Ian Masters. I'm now joined by journalist and novelist Ben Ehrenreich, who has just returned from the West Bank in Palestine. Ben Ehrenreich's reporting has taken him to such places as Afghanistan, Haiti, Cambodia, El Salvador, Mexico, and Riverside. He's written two novels, The Suitor and Ether, which will his new novel will be coming out this fall. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Ehrenreich.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm very glad you could join us today. As I said, you've just returned from the West Bank, where you were working on a story about water resources, water issues. But your trip coincided with the Arab Spring, so let's begin there.
Yeah, I mean, I went there with a focus that's not quite narrow. I mean, I was looking at one issue, trying to look at the occupation through the lens of water, which is something we don't talk about a whole lot in this country, but it's an enormous issue for Palestinians. It's a large issue in Israel as well. But the lack of water has really suffered in the occupied territories incredibly disproportionately. But so it became a way to look at the occupation in general. But when I got there, there were other things going on that didn't have a whole lot to do with water, although the water is sort of relevant to. You know, you find a spring that's been stolen or a cistern that's been demolished at almost every village you go to. The first day that I was in Ramallah happened to be March 15th, which was the day of the big protests all around the West Bank as well as in Gaza to end the division between Hamas and Fatah, which have been split since the election in 2006. And, you know, the way of demanding democracy in Palestine it was a little different than in the rest of the Arab world. And it focused not on the individual rulers in Gaza and the West Bank, but on ending the division between them. And both parties, both Hamas and Fatah, I think, understood that movement as a threat to their own. To their own rule, and both in Gaza and the West Bank, did end up repressing those protests. That first night of protests in Ramallah, I saw seven people carried off in ambulances, beaten up by thugs in the crowd. Fatah was much smarter about sort of trying to co-opt the protests, whereas Hamas was in Gaza was considerably more. Aggressive in putting them down. But it was this very interesting moment, and I think continues to be a really interesting moment, when the kind of post-Oslo status quo really doesn't feel tenable to anyone, or to very few people, and that the powers that have been put in place since Oslo are really seeming like one of the primary hindrances in getting rid of the occupation and fighting against the Israeli occupation.
Well, that movement, demonstrations that began on March 15th, how did they come about? What's the what is that a seriously organized political movement? Another Twitter revolution? Do you know what the origin of it was?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely falls into the. I think there are kind of a couple different sectors of it, but the organizers definitely fall into the same kind of demographic category as the sort of Facebook revolution. I mean, most of the organizers that I met were young, most of them were educated, most of them were English speaking, most of them were quite technologically literate, and it was we're not talking huge numbers. In Ramallah, you know, there were at most 200 people in Al Manara Square, in the central square. But you know, incredibly devoted. They got beaten up that first night, and they were there every night that I was there. You know, people would get out of the hospital and come right back to the square. People were sleeping in the square every night. And you know, then we saw in June in the Nakba protests, several hundred people from that same group more directly confronting Israeli forces. There was a big protest in Colombia, as well as the protests. I think we heard a lot more about the Palestinian refugees in Syria and Lebanon coming across the border, but there were also major protests which were heavily repressed by the Israeli security forces in Colombia, just outside of Ramallah, at the major checkpoint separating Ramallah from Jerusalem. I think this has been a movement that's been building in Palestine since before these revolutionary movements took shape in Tunisia and in Egypt. But the way the organizers talked about it to me was they hadn't been planning to do something as soon as March 15th. But when things started taking off in Egypt, they kind of accelerated their own schedule and knew that they had to kind of try to work with that momentum.
Right.
So they definitely feel some kinship to those other movements around the Middle East.
Okay, I should say this is Tom Lutz sitting in for Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with journalist and author Ben Ehrenreich, recently returned from the West Bank. You wrote a piece in the Los Angeles Times in 2009 that I'm sure made you a lot of new friends. called Zionism is the Problem. And in it, you wrote that Jewish Americans in the 1940s, 1950s, for some time saw a kind of racist strand in Zionism that was called by leaders of major Jewish organizations Hitlerian. Not only was it not considered anti-Semitic, but was part of the mainstream Jewish American position, and that's slowly changed. I'm wondering if this recent trip of yours had any impact on your thinking about that same issue.
Yeah, I think if anything, it deepened my feelings about it, my understanding of it. I think, I think also deepened my sense of the tragedy of it. You know, that until, you know, after the middle of the 20th century, Zionism was a fairly, was far from a mainstream intellectual movement among Jews around the world. You know, most Jews around the world, even today, are more likely to end up in, you know, New York City or its suburbs than to try to go, you know, to the Holy Land. And something happened, I think, really after the 67 war, it became not only the predominant, like, intellectual strain in Judaism, it became kind of the only one. And to question it, to voice any criticism of the Israeli state, particularly to voice any criticism of Zionism, gets you labeled an anti-Semite, a self-hating Jew, whatever. And I think it's terrible for many, many reasons. But I think being there and seeing the massive militarization, both obviously in the occupied territories, but it's also very evident in Israel itself. And the, you know, to use a kind of perhaps too heavy metaphor, the kind of barbed wire wrapped around people's brains and souls kind of really deepened my sense of how terrifically wrong this is. And, you know, I think the recent spate of really openly extremely racist laws being introduced in the Knesset in the last couple of years, and the rise of what had been really extreme right-wing positions in Israel, which are now quite mainstream or fairly mainstream positions, I think illustrates, that it's ultimately impossible to have an ethnically based state I think anywhere in the world, but particularly in an ethnically diverse place such as the land which we now call Israel and Palestine, particularly when there are the kind of extreme militaristic power relations brought about by an occupation. That can only result in rising levels of militarization, paranoia, racism, etc.
Right. Now, what I find very interesting about the movement that you were describing is that it's about bringing Fatah and Hamas together. It's about breaking down that already militarized relationship as well, right? And how exactly does that movement have a name? Are they calling themselves something?
The only name I ever heard people call them, and they call themselves, was like the Shabab, like the youth, the kids, the boys, the guys.
Okay.
Although actually, I don't mean to make it gender specific like that. The organizing group was
the youth,
probably more women than men.
Okay.
There's from what I could tell that they're not. There's not even a particularly uniform ideology. I mean, some had leanings closer to, Marxist groups like the PFLP. Some were very clearly identified themselves as basically Western liberals. But all of them were, staunchly against the occupation and saw the division between, division of Palestinians as, something getting in the way of ever organizing against that.
And your sense of the way this is being received beyond the town square?
My sense was that there was a lot of support for them. There were already some links being developed while I was there between those young protesters, young and mainly urban protesters, because those protests were limited to the cities and larger towns of the West Bank and Gaza. But there were already some links forming between them and the much older and more established movement, which is called the Popular Resistance or the Popular Struggle, which has been ongoing since about 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Involved nonviolent demonstrations in a number of West Bank villages, the most famous being Bilin, Nabi Saleh. In some of those villages, those protests have to do with the wall, which is cutting off huge sectors of their land. And others, like Nabi Saleh, had to do with the settlement nearby taking over a spring. We don't, unless you look really hard for news from Palestine in this country, you're not going to read about these protests. But every single Friday, in at least three and sometimes five or more villages, there are protests which are fiercely repressed by the IDF. Tear gas, rubber bullets, sometimes live ammunition, and taking on kind of incredible losses. These tiny villages, which have huge sectors of their population in jail. Huge percentages of the population injured, which essentially invite the IDF into their, when they take to the streets in their villages, the only consequence is that the military comes in and covers everything with tear gas and kids get arrested, adults get arrested, people get injured, and they're willing to accept these consequences and are out there every single week. And this has been going on for years and we don't hear about it at all.
I feel terrible. That we didn't spend the entire hour because I feel like we're just getting started. I did want to ask you quickly. It is true that that we don't get enough of that kind of news almost anywhere, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show today on Ian Masters. Background briefing. I did want to ask you finally about water, though. As you say, water is a significant issue everywhere, and I assume especially there now.
Yeah, it is, and it's an issue in people's. It's now it's the middle of the summer, and which means that not only in rural parts of the West Bank, but even in larger cities like Bethlehem, people can count on having water just, you know, a couple days a week if they're lucky. Sometimes water is off for many days at a time. The water issue really varies significantly in different parts of the West Bank. It's probably at its worst in the southern Hebron Hills, which is in very south of the West Bank, probably the poorest and certainly the driest part of the West Bank, where not only are there significant natural hurdles to getting enough water, but there have been ongoing aggression by settlers and by the Israeli Defense Forces against Palestinian villages, which takes these really kind of awful forms, often going in and destroying cisterns, filling in cisterns with dirt. And cisterns are, basically it's basically a hole in the ground.
Right.
That collects water during the rainy season, and in a good year will allow a family, enough water to get through the first third of the summer. The consequences of not having that water are quite devastating. But then on a more systematic level, Palestinians are not allowed to, for the most part, and they're very complex bureaucratic background to all of this, but for the most part, Palestinians have not been allowed to drill into the aquifer beneath their own land, which Israel actually draws quite a bit of water from. Even in the kind of wetter parts of the West Bank, there are these extraordinary differences between the fields of settlers and the fields of Palestinians. I mean, you can kind of tell from hundreds of yards away which is a settler's field and which is a Palestinian field.
Well, thank you very much for talking to us today, Ben Ehrenreich. I'm realizing that I am not cut out to be a host of this kind of program. It is just way too depressing. I've been speaking with.
I don't have any happy stories.
I've been speaking with Ben Ehrenreich, and neither do any of my other guests. So, author of the novels *The Suitor* and the forthcoming *Ether*. He's recently returned from the West Bank in Palestine, and your piece will be coming out in Harper's sometime soon.
Sometime soon.
Yeah. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back in a moment. Thanks again, Ben Ehrenreich.
Thanks, Tom.
شرطة تدافعوا عن الناس ليش تدفعوا بالناس ولا في ناس وناس في يهود والباقي كلاته حماس انت جدي لابس ازرق يا هلس سوينا ما لحقتش تشوفنا عم بشت علينا ضوء سيرينا حطيت كلبشات عايدينا يا حكومة انت ملعون